Uninsured Montanans have just a few more hours to sign up for health coverage. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. We'll also have more on that 4.8 earthquake in Yellowstone Park this weekend. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talked with State Labor Commissioner Pam Busey about tomorrow's summit on equal pay and how to close the gender pay gap. The deadline for signing up for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act is just hours away. Uninsured Montanans need to sign up for a plan by midnight tonight or face a potential tax penalty. But Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the last-minute surge in traffic is making that hard to do through the online Obamacare marketplace.
Helena Democratic Senator Christine Kaufman is working as an Affordable Care Act navigator. For the last 6 months, she's been getting paid through a federal grant to help people sign up for a health insurance plan. And as goes human nature, a lot of people are waiting until the last minute.
We've been here taking back-to-back appointments since Friday morning, and we're going up until the deadline tonight.
She's been working in Bozeman for the last few days. Today she's at the public library. And she says it's encouraging to see so much late interest, but it's bringing its frustrations.
We can't get all the way through the process for one reason or another.
The Affordable Care Act website, healthcare.gov, has been beleaguered from the first second it launched last October. Crashes, glitches, it was nearly impossible to sign up for a plan at the beginning. The Obama administration dispatched a lot of resources to fix the blunder, and the site has been working much better since the first few weeks. But it still hasn't been able to handle all this late traffic. Trying to start the process three times today, each time I was greeted with, healthcare.gov has a lot of visitors right now. It says it needs me to wait, quote, so we can make sure there's room for you to have a good experience on our site, end quote. Montana Commissioner of Securities and Insurance Monica Lindeen's office regulates the insurance industry in the state and is monitoring the implementation of Obamacare. Communications Director Jennifer McKee believes the commissioner's office and insurance companies are seeing this first year as a transition period.
I think we wish the lessons wouldn't have been so difficult to learn.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services did anticipate the late web traffic surge, leading to more difficulties with the site. So people who started the process before the deadline, they won't be locked out if it was the website's fault.
If you were in line, as they say, you will be able to finish, even if you weren't able to actually log into healthcare.gov.
Residents who missed the deadline this year may be assessed a penalty on this year's taxes of at least $95. There are a number of exemptions to that rule, such as for those whose annual income is below the poverty level. Otherwise, though, after the deadline, the marketplace is closed until the next open enrollment period. That will be half as long as this one has been, mid-November of this year through mid-February 2015. Communications Director with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Montana, John Doran, says there is a rationale behind only allowing people to register during a small window.
To avoid situations where somebody breaks their leg skiing and enrolls in a plan the next day, there has to be an open enrollment period.
Still, he says if Montanans go through a life-changing event,
say you have a child, you get married, you change jobs, you lose your health insurance for some reason,
if one of those things happens, you will be allowed to enroll outside of the normal window. Montanans had applied for almost 23,000 health plans through the marketplace as of the beginning of March. It will take a few more weeks to know the total number of plans sold in the Affordable Care Act's first tumultuous year, but Navigator Christine Kaufman believes it has been worth the last 6 months of strife, worth it to get people covered.
We're pretty pleased overall. We're also pretty tired. We've been doing this for a long time.
I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, a landslide has forced the closure of westbound lanes on Interstate 90, 5 miles east of the Idaho border. However, that does not mean you will not be able to travel west on I-90, as traffic is being diverted to the eastbound lane for 1.5 miles around the slide. Montana Department of Transportation officials say there are flaggers and pilot cars in that stretch of highway to help with the traffic. But if you are traveling west via I-90, expect delays. Earlier, all westbound traffic had been being detoured at mile marker 33 in St. Regis to Montana 135 and Highway 200 north to the Sandpoint area. Oversized loads are still required to take that detour. The landslide is at mile marker 6.5, and crews were working to clear the slide. Park County authorities say a Gardner man fatally shot a woman he knew before shooting himself with the same handgun. Undersheriff Scott Hamilton says 63-year-old Steve A. Cole shot 59-year-old Debbie J. Roberts twice Thursday afternoon before killing himself with a shot to the head. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports that Hamilton described autopsy reports today in the murder-suicide. The sheriff's office says Cole and Roberts were in a relationship several years ago. Roberts called emergency officials Thursday and said Cole was trying to break into her home and had already shot at her. Sheriff's deputies and Yellowstone National Park rangers found Cole dead at the home and Roberts in critical condition, and she later died at the scene. A judge says there is nothing preventing 95 people from pursuing their sex abuse lawsuit in state court against an order of nuns in western Montana. U.S. bankruptcy judge Terry Myers says in a Friday order, the Ursuline sisters aren't covered by the automatic stay granted to the Roman Catholic Diocese of Helena when the diocese filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Some 362 plaintiffs filed two lawsuits against the diocese and the Ursulines over the abuse between the 1940s and 1970s. The diocese filed for bankruptcy protection as part of a $15 million settlement with most of the plaintiffs. The Ursulines are not participating in the settlement. Myers says the Ursulines are a non-debtor co-defendant, and a separate unusual circumstances finding must be made to stay the case against them. The American Heart Association says a $4.6 million donation will go to improve the emergency medical response to heart attacks in rural Montana. The association and Governor Steve Bullock said today the donation from the Leona M. and Harry B. Helmsley Charitable Trust will create a three-year Mission Lifeline project in Montana. The aim will be to equip hospitals and emergency responders with mobile equipment and training, plus data tools, coordinated protocols, and a public education campaign. The mission targets diagnosis and treatment for heart attacks caused by total artery blockage, which are often deadly without a fast response. Those heart attacks are called ST-elevated myocardial infarction episodes, or STEMI. Health officials say nearly 1,800 people in Montana were hospitalized with heart attacks in 2012, and 777 of those were STEMI cases. A California utility that invested in a Montana wind farm is accusing the developer of fraud. San Diego Gas and Electric alleges a subsidiary of Spanish wind developer Nature Inner concealed that federal wildlife officials recommended the wind project get a permit in case it harms eagles. The utility claims Nature Inner did not disclose the government's recommendation to induce SDG&E to invest in the Rimrock wind farm near Cutbank. SDG&E and Nature Inner have filed dueling lawsuits in California and Montana as part of a dispute over the 126 turbine project. At issue is whether Nature Inner followed through on contractual obligations to protect eagles and other birds that nest near the site. A Nature Inner spokesman rejected the fraud allegations made in court documents filed Friday in California Supreme Court. The U.S. Geological Survey says the magnitude 4.8 earthquake that shook northern Yellowstone National Park is the strongest there since 1980. But the Sunday quake was still considered relatively light. Edward O'Brien has more with the director of the Earthquake Studies Office and senior research geologist at the Montana Bureau of Mines and Geology, Mike Stickney.
There was a patch of fault surface that slipped and produced a magnitude 4.8 earthquake.
What does that mean when you say it slipped?
Imagine two blocks of rock, and they moved past each other briefly on a surface that separates the two blocks. And that sudden slipping motion generates the seismic waves that we feel as an earthquake.
How deep was this?
I believe the earthquake was about 6 kilometers below the surface. I don't have the exact depth right in front of me at the moment.
But ballpark about six.
Yes, fairly shallow in terms of crustal seismicity.
So help put then a 4.8 quake in that part of the world into perspective for us. How significant an event was that?
I believe it was the largest earthquake within the park since the fall of 1985. A magnitude of 4.8 is big enough to feel over a limited region. As we know, it was felt in the towns of Gardner and West Yellowstone. There were apparently reports that came from Rexburg, Idaho, as well as the Bozeman area. So it was perceptible over a fairly broad region. But the epicentral area within the park at this time of year, of course, was very few people around to observe it.
No significant damage that we know of.
No significant damage that's been reported. If you put this size of an earthquake directly under one of Montana's cities, you would just about be at the threshold where you might expect some minor damage.
So this weekend's quakes and aftershocks in California rattled some nerves. The timing seems interesting. Do you think there's a connection between the two events?
I think it is just coincidence, luck of the draw. There are earthquakes of this size in the magnitude 4.5 to 5.5 range that occur daily throughout the world. And every so often those happen to occur in populated areas where they are felt by people. And I think it is just pure coincidence that we happen to have two felt earthquakes in the western U.S. in short order. There has been ongoing seismicity in the northern part of the park up in the North Geyser Basin now for the past half year or so. There have been a number of swarms of typically smaller earthquakes, but some of those swarms have been quite vigorous. And to the best of anybody's knowledge at this point, it is just a continuing activity in this very active area.
And I know you've got to be sick to death of this question, but anytime there is activity like this in the Yellowstone area, people always say, oh, the caldera's waking up, it's going to be catastrophe.
Well, we have no evidence whatsoever to support that conjecture. There is nothing that's been observed about this particular earthquake or the pattern of aftershocks that would lead us to believe that it is anything other than a tectonic earthquake. We don't see any involvement of a volcanic signature in this event.
Okay. Aftershocks in the Yellowstone area?
There have been quite a number. I believe the largest one has been up about a magnitude 3.1 or so, but in the first 6 hours or so after the largest event, there were probably several hundred very tiny earthquakes that were observed on a seismograph right near the epicenter.
Mike Stickney, Director of Earthquake Studies Office and Senior Research Geologist at the Montana Bureau of Mines and Geology. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Montana's largest city has blown past its snowfall record with 100 inches tallied so far in a season that forecasters say is likely to keep churning into April and beyond. National Weather Service meteorologist Joe Lester said Billings averages about 55 inches of snow annually in records dating to 1934. The city of 105,000 people along the banks of the Yellowstone River topped that figure back in early February. It broke 100 inches with a storm that continued through today. The nearby Beartooth Mountains also have been hit with heavy snows. That means farmers on the northern plains should have water for irrigation when spring arrives, but flood risks are up again 3 years after hundreds of Montana homes and low-lying areas got swamped following another snowy, wet winter. Frustrated by the federal government's lack of progress in cleaning up the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, the state of Washington has issued its own plan for the work. Democratic Governor Jay Inslee said today that his plan seeks to keep the cleanup of the nation's most contaminated nuclear weapons site on schedule. Hanford for decades made plutonium for nuclear weapons and now is engaged in cleaning up the radioactive waste left over from that work. The wastes are stored in 177 giant underground tanks, some of which are leaking. Inslee says he has become concerned by the federal government's repeated failures to meet cleanup deadlines imposed by a 2010 federal court decree. He says nearly all the court-imposed deadlines involving Hanford storage tanks are likely to be missed. Montana women earn 67 cents on the dollar of what men make, placing us 39th in the country when it comes to the gender pay gap. That fact prompted Governor Steve Bullock to form an Equal Pay for Equal Work Task Force and to co-sponsor a summit on equal pay that kicks off tonight and runs through tomorrow at Montana State University in Bozeman. State Labor Commissioner Pam Busey is co-chair of the Equal Pay Task Force and a participant in tomorrow's summit. In this feature interview, Busey talks with News Director Sally Mock about Montana's gender pay gap and how to fix it.
Montana ranks 39th in the country in terms of where we are in closing the gender pay gap, and we're below the national average, 67 cents on the dollar, I think, to 77 cents. Why are we in that position? Why are we worse than the national average and many states?
You know, I guess that's part of the job of the task force, Sally. It's a really complicated issue. I wish there was a magic bullet that would explain it. Some of the reason is, you know, Montana's wages overall are some of the lowest in the nation. As you know, we're 36th to 39th in the nation for low wages anyway, for both males and females and everyone else who lives here. So that's a significant part of it. We have even less women in non-traditional jobs in Montana than other states. We have less women in leadership than some other states. We also have less bigger companies. So a lot of the family leave policies, a lot of the federal laws that prevent discrimination don't apply to most Montana employers. So it's really complicated. There are certainly those institutional barriers, but there are also just cultural barriers. And, you know, we suffer from those in Montana as much, if not more, in the expectations that, you know, we as women have and that others have of us. So, again, I keep saying the reason that we hosted this summit is the task force really believed that it was important that Montana understand just how complicated the situation is and also how serious it is, what it means to the bottom line of Montana's economy to have 20 to 30 cents less an hour on the streets of Main Street and what that means over a lifetime and what that means in retirement. And frankly, we also wanted to educate the business community about how much women, you know, women are the main consumers of all household goods, but even more importantly, they are also the purchasers of most business goods. So there really is a bottom line for business component to making sure you have women making important decisions in your company, because frankly, it's women that are going to be buying your goods or buying the goods to make your goods. So it's a really important thing to look at for the economy as well as for the social justice kinds of just morality and fairness issues.
And it's also not true, correct me if I'm wrong, that women are a second income always. One statistic I read was that 40% of the women who work in Montana are the primary breadwinners for their family.
That's correct. The amount of women that are head of households, I've seen a couple of different numbers, but it's anywhere from 45% to 50%. So, that's one of the cultural barriers. A lot of the value we've placed on traditional women's work factored in that there was another income supplementing that. And that's just frankly not the truth. I don't know if it was the truth when, you know, we valued work at that, you know, when work was valued, but it's certainly not the truth today. Women are head of households, and in 90-some percent of households, women's income is a critical component to how that household succeeds. So the idea that women can afford to make less is a notion that we really need to take off the table now.
And as you mentioned earlier, the myth, and it is a myth, I think, that it's good business sense to pay women less than men. Why would that persist when all the evidence is to the contrary?
You know, I really don't know, Sally. And I think the great thing that's happened recently, and I credit Sheryl Sandberg, there's all kinds of things that have happened that have raised this issue up. But I do think the business community is starting to wonder, you know, where this came from. And if you look at some of the major employers, GE, GM, Google, Facebook, all of those, you know, some big Fortune 500 corporations, many of them are really implementing aggressive strategies to get women into leadership positions. And particularly after the recession, there's all kinds of data that showed that the financial institutions that had women, women on their boards and women making important management decisions, those businesses fared much better throughout the recession than the businesses that didn't. So again, I think, you know, sadly, it takes some experience and some time and unfortunately some business failures to realize that having diversity, having women in leadership in your companies and on your boards and in your nonprofit organizations really does help the bottom line. So So I think we're behind. We certainly are behind in Montana, and some of that is because we do lack some of those bigger corporate employers that are innovative and really on the front lines. So we have some educating to do, and I think anyone that would have the opportunity to come to the summit will get to hear some of that information. You know, we have over 50 speakers of some of the most gifted and talented women and men in Montana and around the country to talk about the bottom line of this kind of pay inequity and what it really is doing to the main streets of Montana and to Montana families.
A fact sheet that your office puts out on equal pay in Montana has some, to me, surprising things in it. One is that the best industry for equal pay is construction in Montana, and the worst is finance and insurance and legal occupations.
I know. It is startling. Here's the interesting follow-up to that. Though construction is the most equal, only 6% of women in Montana participate in the construction industry. So we have a host of panels tomorrow talking about non-traditional employment for women, because frankly, that is the employment, the plumbers, the electricians, all of those traditionally male-dominated industries and trades. Those folks make a lot more money than some of the more traditional occupations that females have. I think that, you know, that's an important issue. We really need to talk about helping women get into the electrical trade or the plumbing trade or the construction industry. We also need, though, to talk just as much about why we value teachers and child care workers and health care workers, why their work, even though it requires the same amount of technical skill and training or education, why we value it so much lower in terms of pay. So I think there are really important things to talk about with that, but I do think it's a good statistic to show because, you know, just getting more women into construction really would turn the dial.
A lot of the new jobs in Montana are in those fields, of course, and not in the so-called pink-collar jobs. Other new jobs that Montana wants to attract are so-called STEM jobs, science, technology, engineering, and math. And nationally, a statistic I saw was less than 25% of math and computer science jobs are held by women, and only 11% of engineering jobs. I'm not sure what the stats are for Montana, but probably as bad or worse.
Yeah, they are worse. They're around 11 and 12% for STEM careers. Interestingly, we just had our task force meeting, and on one of the panels tomorrow, the dean of Missoula College is presenting. His name is Dean Barry Good, and he went through his whole college and traced the last 5 years of all those STEM programs. And in some of those programs, women were only 2% of the students enrolled. So we do really have a long way to go. And again, those are the up-and-coming jobs. Those are the jobs of the future. Those are going to be the majority of jobs in the United States and in Montana. And so we really need to think about how we're going to reach out and ensure that women and girls are enrolling in those programs at a much higher level.
And in that sense, mentors are crucial, aren't they, for women who have been successful in those fields to do what they can to bring women and girls into those fields is really, really helpful, isn't it?
It really is, and there's a lot of data that demonstrates that. Women are fierce advocates for other women, for their friends, for their family. They're not as fierce of advocates for themselves. So having support systems for women that are entering, especially those non-traditional roles, it proves to be critical for women to just have someone say, you can do this, this is how I did it. It really makes an incredible difference for women's success in those occupations. So again, there's a lot we can learn. We're really excited about the fact that this summit was sold out within a week of advertising it the first time. So we, you know, clearly it's not a small group of people that are interested in this issue. Everybody would like more information about what's happening with equal pay in Montana.
And it's a crucial thing for the future of Montana's economic prosperity, which I think is probably the main point that you want to get across, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I can't stress enough when you think of having that much less income on the streets every day being spent on rent and groceries, and then when you think of what that accumulates to over a lifetime in terms of retirement, It is critical that we move the dial on this issue in Montana for the prosperity of Montana's economy.
Well, I've been speaking with State Labor Commissioner Pam Busey, who is also co-chair of the Governor's Equal Pay for Equal Work Task Force, and she's talking about the Governor's Equal Pay Summit, which kicks off tonight in Bozeman and continues all day tomorrow at Montana State University. Commissioner Busey, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Sally.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with isolated rain showers, some patchy freezing fog, and lows will be in the 20s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain, some patchy freezing fog as well, and highs should be in the upper 40s to mid-50s. In central Montana tonight, look for mostly cloudy skies with isolated rain and snow showers and patchy freezing fog through the night. Expect lows in the 20s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain and snow showers through the day, and highs should be 35 to 40 degrees. In southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain and snow, and lows should be 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow calls for increasing clouds, bringing a slight chance of rain and snow showers through the day. Expect highs in the 40s. And now for the editorial comments of Julia Altimus.
If cities are serious about tackling climate change, then the solution may be found in building the city of tomorrow to look more like the city of yesterday. As glass and steel towers continue to rise, wood skyscrapers are likely to start sprouting alongside. Multi-story and high-rise wood buildings are already planned or rising in Europe and Canada. They are architecturally distinct, and they are made of the original green building material. When the president signed the 2014 Farm Bill in February, he directed his administration, working through the White House Rural Council, to lead a new Made in Rural America export and investment initiative. This initiative is charged with uniting federal resources to aid rural businesses and leaders to take advantage of new investment opportunities and access new customers and markets, both at home and abroad. As a response, U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack recently took the first step by announcing a partnership with Woodworks, an organization that provides support to the wood building industry to educate architects and engineers on the potential of using wood as a commercial structural building material. In addition, the White House Rural Council and the U.S. Department of Agriculture recently hosted a workshop in Washington, D.C. as part of the Council's work to enhance economic opportunity in rural America, entitled Building with Wood, Jobs and the Environment. As a participant, I was invited to discuss the environmental benefits of building with wood and opportunities to advance the use of wood in high-rise construction. At this workshop, Secretary Vilsack said, "Wood may be one of the world's oldest building materials, but it is now also one of the most advanced." The secretary went on to say, "Building stronger markets for innovative new wood products supports sustainable forestry, helps to counteract greenhouse gas emissions, and puts rural America in the forefront of an emerging industry." At the launch of the International Year of the Forest last week, Secretary Vilsack announced a three-part plan addressing the Forest Service and USDA's current green building practices. The strategy directs the Forest Service to preferentially select wood in new building construction while maintaining a commitment to certified green building materials. The Secretary asked the Forest Service to examine ways to increase its commitment to green building by reporting on ways to enhance the research and development being done around these materials, and to actively look for opportunities to demonstrate the innovative use of wood for all new structures of 10,000 square feet or more. In carrying out this plan, Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell issued a directive to all districts calling for increased use of locally milled timber in all new agency buildings and facilities. Secretary Vilsack also directed other USD agencies to incorporate this policy of using domestic wood products as a preferred green building material for all future USDA buildings. By making the case for more wood in construction, the USDA is calling attention to the value of sustainably grown and managed forests and the products they produce in storing carbon throughout the building's life cycle. Emerging engineered wood technologies and other wood products can be used in industrial building projects such as high-rise construction. A 3- to 5-story building made from wood has the same emission control as taking up to 550 cars off the road for 1 year. Wood-based designs have also been demonstrated to improve energy efficiency, thereby reducing energy consumption for heating and cooling. Increasing the demand for domestic, sustainably harvested timber products will directly impact rural America. Presently, the market for wood and other related forest products supports over 1 million jobs, mostly in rural areas. In addition, the 22 million family forest owners, who actually own more timberland than the federal government, also rely on new economic opportunities as markets expand. Even though the momentum around building tall with wood is exciting, what is even more encouraging is a recognition by our state and national leaders that forest health is directly tied to a sustainable forest products industry. To decouple is to lose both. On behalf of the Montana Wood Products Association, I am Julia Altimus. Thanks for listening.
Julia Altimus is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.